Welcome to The Conspiracy Files. I'm Jerry Pippin. In a moment, we'll be talking to Paris Flamand. He spent 2 years of his life down in New Orleans living and breathing with Jim Garrison, doing the investigation of the famed DA from New Orleans and the subject of that Oliver Stone movie, JFK. Flamand wanted to find out what made Garrison tick. What he found out was very interesting. Flamand has written Assassination of America, the Kennedy coup d'etat. It's the definitive story and an inside look at the Jim Garrison investigation. He delves into all of the JFK, RFK story and the assassinations and many details never before released by anyone else. It's available in several volumes. Before we talk with Paris, let's turn the hands of time back to November 29th, 1963. 1 week to the day after the murder of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas. In this recording, we hear Lyndon B. Johnson talking with J. Edgar Hoover, who was director of the FBI. Listen closely, and you'll find the description of what happened in Dallas. Discussion about Jack Ruby, the man who killed Lee Harvey Oswald in the Dallas jail. Oswald, of course, was accused of the assassination of Kennedy. Hoover reveals to Johnson that there actually was evidence that there were two Oswalds. He tells the president about Officer J.D. Trippett and how he was killed in the movie theater by Oswald shortly after the assassination. This is the actual recording, the actual phone conversation, as released by the LBJ Presidential Library.
This angle in Mexico is giving us a great deal of trouble because the stories I have, this man Oswald getting $6,500 from the Cuban embassy and then coming back to this country with it. We're not able to prove that fact. The information was that he was there on the 18th of September in Mexico City, and we are able to prove conclusively he was in New Orleans that day. Now, then they changed the date. The story came in changing the date to the 28th of September, and he was in Mexico City on the 28th. Now, the Mexican police have again arrested this woman, Duran, who's a member of the Cuban embassy, and will hold her for 2-3 more days. And we've got to confront her with the original informant who saw the money pass, so he says, and we're also going to put the lie detector test on him. Meantime, of course, Castro's hollering his head off.
Can you pay attention to those lie detector tests?
I would not pay 100% attention to them. All that they are is a psychological asset in an investigation. I wouldn't want to be a part to sending a man to the chair on a lie detector. For instance, we have found many cases where we've used them, and in a bank where there's been embezzlement, and a person will confess before the lie detector test is finished. They're more or less fearful of the fact that the lie detector test will show them guilty. Psychologically, they have that advantage because it's a misnomer to call it a lie detector, because what it really is, it's the evaluation of the chart that is made by this machine. And that evaluation is made by a human being. And any human being can be apt to make a wrong interpretation. So I would not myself go on that alone. If, on the other hand, if this fellow Oswald had lived, and had taken me out of the lie detector test, and it had shown definitely that he had done these various things, together with the evidence that we very definitely have, it would have just added that much more strength to it. There's no question but that he is the man. Now, the fingerprints and things we have. This fellow Rubenstein down there, he has offered to take the lie detector test, but his lawyer has got to be cross-consulted first, and I doubt whether the lawyer will allow him. He's one of these criminal lawyers from the West Coast, and somewhat like an Edward Bennett Williams type, and almost as much of a shyster.
Have you got any relationship between the two here?
Between Rubenstein?
Yeah.
No, at the present time, we have not. There was a story down there that...
Were you ever in his bar and stuff like that?
There was a story that this fellow had been in this nightclub, this strip tease joint that he has, but that has not been able to be confirmed. Now, This fellow Rubenstein is a very shady character, has a bad record, street brawler, fighter, that sort of thing. And in the place in Dallas, if a fellow came in there and couldn't pay his bill completely, Rubenstein would beat the very devil out of him and throw him out of the place. He was that kind of a fella. He didn't drink, didn't smoke, boasted about that. He's what I would put in the category, one of his egomaniacs. He likes to be in the limelight. He knew all the police in that white light district where the joints are in there. And he also let them come in, see the show, get food, and get liquor and so forth. That's how I think he got into police headquarters. Because they accepted him as kind of a police character hanging around police headquarters. And for that reason raised no question. They never made any moves as the pictures show, even when they saw him approaching this fella and got up right to him and pressed his pistol against Oswald's stomach. Neither of the police officers on either side made any move to push him away or to grab him. It wasn't until after the gun was fired that they then moved. Now, of course, that is not the highest degree of efficiency, so to say. Secondly, the chief of police admits that he moved him in the morning as a convenience and at the request of the motion picture people who wanted to have daylight. He should have moved him at night, but he didn't. Those derelictions in that phase. But so far as tying Rubenstein and Oswald together, we haven't as yet done so. There have been a number of stories come in. We've tied Oswald into the Civil Liberties Union in New York, membership into that, and then, of course, into this this Cuban Fair Play Committee, which was pro-Castro and dominated by communism and financed to some extent by the Castro government.
How many shots were fired?
Three.
Any of them fired at me?
No, there was nothing. All three at the president, and we have them. Two of the shots fired at the president were splinted, but they had characteristics on them so that our ballistic expert was able to prove that they were fired by this gun. The third shot, which hit the president, he was hit by the first and the third. The second shot hit the governor. The third shot is a complete bullet that wasn't shattered, and that's rolled out of the president's head. It tore a large part of the president's head off. And in trying to massage his heart at the hospital, on the way to the hospital, they apparently loosened that and that fell onto the stretcher, and we recovered that, and we have that, and we have the gun here also.
Were they aiming at the president?
They were aiming directly at the president. There's no question about that. This telescopic lens which I've looked through, it brings a person as close to you as if they were sitting right beside you. And we also have tested the fact that you could fire, those three shots were fired within 3 seconds. There's been some stories going around in the papers and so forth that must have been more than one man, but because no one man could fire those shots from the time that they were fired. We've just proved that by the actual test that we've made.
How did it happen? They hit Connally.
Connally turned to the president when the first shot was fired. And I think in that turning, it was where he got hit.
If he hadn't turned, he probably wouldn't have got hit.
I think that's very likely.
When the president got hit second?
No, the president wasn't hit with the second one.
If Connally hadn't been in his way.
Oh, yes. The president no doubt would have been hit.
He'd been hit three times.
He'd been hit three times. You know, on the fifth floor of that building where we found the gun and the wrapping paper in which the gun was wrapped, and upon which we find the full fingerprints of this man Oswald, on that floor we found the three empty shells that had been fired and one shell that had not been fired. In other words, there were four shells apparently, and he had fired three, but didn't fire the fourth one. He then threw the gun aside, came down, and at the entrance of the building, he was stopped by a police officer, and some manager in the building told the police officer, well, he's all right, he works for you, you needn't hold him. So they let him go. That's how he got out. And then he got on a bus, the bus driver has identified him, and went out to his home. And got hold of a jacket that he wanted for some purpose and came back downtown, walking downtown, and the police officer who was killed stopped him, not knowing who he was and not knowing whether he was the man, but they were just on suspicion, and he fired, of course, and killed the police officer. Then he walked walked.
You can prove that.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, we can prove that. Then he walked about another two blocks and went to the theater. And the woman at the theater window selling the tickets, she was so suspicious of the way he was acting. And she said he was carrying a gun. He had a revolver at that time, with which he had killed the police officer. He went into the theater, and then she notified the police, and the police and our man down there went in there and located this particular man. He had quite a struggle with him. He fought like a regular lion, and he had to be subdued, of course, and his brother was then brought out, of course, taken to the police headquarters. But he apparently had come down the five flights of steps stairway from the fifth floor. So far as we found out, the elevator was not used, although he could have used it, but nobody remembers whether it was or whether it wasn't.
Well, your conclusion is that he's the one that did it. B, the man he's after was a president. C, he would have hit it three times except the government turned.
I think that's correct.
Four, that there's no connection between he and Ruby that you can detect now. And five, whether he was connected with the Cuban operation with money you were trying to...
That's what we're trying to nail down now. Because he was strongly pro-Castro. He was strongly anti-American. And he had been in correspondence, which we have, with the Soviet embassy here in Washington, and with the American Civil Liberties Union, and with this committee for fair play to Cuba. We have copies of the correspondence. So we've got it nailed down in his contact with them. None of those letters, however, dealt with any indication of violence or contemplated assassination. They were dealing with the matter of a visa for his wife to go back to Russia.
In a moment, we'll be back to delve into the investigation of the killing of JFK and RFK. Paris Flamand is our guest, the consummate expert on the Kennedy assassinations. Don't go away. Why visit the Grand Canyon in Arizona? Marv Mason knows why.
Mainly because the Grand Canyon is known as one of the seven natural wonders of the world.
No one gives a more personalized tour or knows more about the Grand Canyon than Marvelous Marv.
My main thing is education on the geology, because the Grand Canyon is a life record. It shows us where we were at one time on the planet with the continental drift and all the layers that were laid down by sediments, and then how the canyon was carved. And, of course, the views, you know, a picture doesn't do it justice. But it's nice to have somebody there tell you about it that's lived there.
It's the best way to tour the Grand Canyon. Marv picks you up in a modern van at your hotel in the Grand Canyon area and takes you on a day-long tour. Contact Marvelous Marv Vacation Tours. Call and talk to him personally. 928-707-0291. Or visit his website.
MarvelousMarv.com. Real easy.
The Assassination of America, a series of in-depth books by Paris Flamand, a noted author and expert on JFK and RFK, and Jim Garrison. It's hard to believe that Robert F. Kennedy was killed 40 years ago, and we just passed 45 years on President Kennedy. Before we get to the reason that he calls it the Kennedy coup d'etat, let's get to know the man, Paris Flamand. Paris, how are you?
Very well. How are you?
Pretty good. You're quite a legend, and it's an honor having you here.
It's my pleasure.
And we're going to talk about a few things here, but I would be remiss if we didn't bring up your entire career. You hung around Greenwich Village and knew quite a few interesting people, I take it.
Actually, dozens. They have ranged from scientific people, theatrical people, science fiction writers. I knew many of them. Almost all of the flying saucer kooks, sports people. Living in New York.
And a virtual who's who of entertainment, from Jacqueline Suzanne to Jackie Gleason to Johnny Carson, you name it.
Right. Well, so many of them lived or worked there. You have to remember that during that period, that was the metropolis of broadcasting, and now, of course, it's so much of it has gone out to the West Coast with television, but in radio days, almost everybody worked out of New York, and so it wasn't surprising that one might meet a good many of them.
Oh, I know that. When I was a young man, I decided I would go to New York and be a stand-up comic, and hung around a place called, I'm trying to remember, it was a 55 Grove, I do know that, in the Village, and it was an upstairs little room where they did showcases. And I, for the life of me, can't remember the name of the place, but there were some pretty famous people even back in those days, 67, 68.
Are you talking about a cafe, live performances?
Yes. Uh-huh. And so most of the listeners that weren't around during that time or didn't live in New York.
That's very true.
They just they don't understand how much of an action place that was.
Well, John had... was estimated generally at around 26 million listeners, and 95% of them were east of the Mississippi. But because of some atmospheric phenomena that occasionally occurred,
The
skip signal, and we get messages from California and Arizona.
Well, I used to try to pick up Long John Neville in here in Oklahoma, and you could do it. And you could do it some night on a skip. Especially when in, I believe it was before he went over to NBC, I think it's when he's on WOR at the time.
Yes, well, his great years were at OR. The NBC attracted him by an absurd amount of money, and they built a new studio for him and everything, and it was just not his métier. It was just was not the old show. It was not the peak of his career. As a matter of fact, thereafter, when his contract ran out, they renewed it once, and then it wasn't renewed again because he simply didn't have the feeling for that place that he had had for the old, rather beat-up studio over at WOR.
One time he was actually out of New Jersey, right?
Yes, well, he began in 1956. I'll try to make this in a matter of a few seconds. The vice president of WOR, for reasons I don't recall, was driving around out in New Jersey, and he saw this enormous sign about 50 or 60 feet long, which simply said Long John Neville. And he drove into the parking area to see what it was, and John had a huge auction operation out there in which he sold virtually anything you can think of in an auction format. And Bob Smith was so impressed with the skill of John as a pitchman, he suggested that he come on and do a 15-minute radio spot at the transmitter out in Carteret, New Jersey. John did about four shows, and they spread it to an hour. And within 6 months, they pulled him from out there to the main.
So they took him into Manhattan, and he did 5.5 hours ultimately.
Yeah, well, that was the 1440 Broadway, just below Times Square, and. The minute he came into the main studio, he did the... there was a period of about a month or so he did a four-hour shift. They ran from 12 to 4, and then they spread it down to 5. On rare occasions, he even did to 5:30. But for all those decades, he did 5 hours a night, usually six nights a week, occasionally only 5. And Sunday was always a repeat tape.
Now, how did you get involved with him?
Well, that's another odd story. I arrived in the Village when I was about 18, and after a decade, a rather erratic and erotic decade, I simply decided that I needed to withdraw entirely from society and just meditate on what I was going to do with the rest.
In other words, Greenwich Village finally got you down.
Yes.
It's quite a lifestyle there.
So I took a room on the fifth floor. north, just north of the village on 23rd Street, just a small studio, and stopped seeing people, except for my closest friend, a poet named Loco Raley. And he used to bring me occasional news of what was going on and what have you, but I really saw almost nobody. But I listened to the radio a lot, mostly music. But one night I happened on to John's show and found it rather entertaining. And one of his people misquoted John Keats, which irritated me. So I just scribbled off a postcard, and my friend Loker mailed it for me. And about 10 days later, the landlady climbed all those stairs and said, "There's a telephone call for you." And I said, "I don't take calls." And so the next day, she came back again. She said, "They're calling again." And I said, "Who is it?" And she said, "It's a radio station." Well, I won't bother you with all that, but eventually I went through his producer, his secretary, etc., and finally I answered the phone, and it was John himself. And his opening line was, well, I can't say exactly what it is. And in effect, why in the hell don't you want to answer the goddamn phone?
Right.
I said, because I'm not socializing. I'm not involved with people these days. And we talked for a little while and got along rather well. And he talked me into coming up and doing a guest shot on the show. And as he put it, as a village poet, we've never had anything like that on the show before. And I thought, I bet you haven't. And so I went up, and we got along famously, and it was a very successful show. And so I
one thing led to another.
Well, I started simply being one of the regular panelists. I was on, generally speaking, about once every 10 days, and that got down to about once or twice a week.
So for people who aren't familiar with that, I imagine it'd be more akin to the old Jack Parr show. You have several people on a panel who may or may not be well known, and they would be regulars, right?
There's nothing like it today, because A, it ran for 5 hours. B, it had a regular a guest, a moderator, but it also had three or four panelists that were rotated. We had a stable of about, at one point, probably 30 panelists, a dozen of them being specialists, but we had about 8 or 10 or 12 that were rotated regularly.
And so all of those panelists became regular characters, and people would enjoy listening to them as well as what they were saying.
Absolutely. They became personalities. They got the fan mail, and people would, when we had call-ins, people would call in to ask about or criticize one or the other of them. And after about 6 or 7 months, John's producer, who was tended to be fond of the bottle, simply became inefficient. And John, much to my surprise, because it was not my field of activity at all, asked if I would be interested in producing the show. And it kind of intrigued me. As I say, I had not done anything like that before. I'd done live performance direction and what have you, but never anything on radio except the appearances I'd been making. And I accepted, and I was with him for it was almost 5 years.
How did you get your name, Paris? That's an unusual.
My father was a literary scholar, and he took it from the Greek legend of Paris and Helen.
Interesting. Interesting.
Actually, Vincent Desmond Paris de Flamont.
The reason, you know, we'll probably end up doing several shows over the years here, because you know a lot of people. I do a lot of entertainment shows, and we'll get to that. But I wanted to talk to you basically about the JFK thing and your book. You tell us a little bit about this book. It's actually more than just a book.
Well, originally it was a book called The Kennedy Conspiracy. That was the first book on Garrison's investigation, and about the fourth or fifth actually four volumes, 800 and 1850 pages, 150 pages of more than 400 photographs and graphs, etc. I mean, it's a monumental work. It took me about 3.5 years to do it, and although compared to the speed with which some people write, that was pretty fast. But as I say, it's a four-volume work, and the title, of course, is The Assassination of America.
Now, it's available on your website.
It is available on my website.
And we'll give that website again here in a minute. We already have once, but the four volumes, that's a lot.
It is.
And 1,600 and some odd pages, that's a lot.
Well, the first volume is completely concentrated on the actual killing and Dallas and everything surrounding that. The second volume is on Garrison's investigation, and the third volume is on the analysis of who, why, what, when, and where the likely persons responsible for the act. And the last volume is index and indices, 30 appendices, and photographs of 75 of the best-known critics and biographies of about 30 of them, and reviews of the Posner books, and the Zugolosi books, four or five reviews by prominent critics in the last book.
Now, when we talk about it had to be a monumental job just going over those 400 frames that you put in that book.
And of course, it has interminable bibliography, and it's something you feel should be in a total survey of the case. It's there.
Well, we're going to talk about it for a little while here, if it's okay with you. It took you a long time to put this together. How did you meet Jim Garrison?
I was contracted to do a book called The Age of Flying Saucers, which was a historical study on that entire phenomenon.
Yeah, we're going to do a show about that some night. You know, a lot of my shows deal with this subject, and late night radio, back in the 50s, did as well.
Well, of course, that was one of John's pet subjects.
Yeah.
And we had every contactee known to man on it, mostly 4, 5, 10 times. If you're familiar with that era, George Adamski and George King and
sure.
Dan Fry, and we had all of them on over and over and over again.
Yeah, Dr. King, I know about him, and George Adamski, of course.
We had Howard Manger and his wife on, and God, there's so many, it's hard for me to...
Now, back in the 50s, a lot of our listeners wouldn't know this, but this was a hot topic all the way from 47 of Roswell, the big flap in 52. It was in the major papers, pictures of UFOs over Washington, D.C. Do you remember that?
That 19, July 1952.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing was that during the very hot period for saucers, as distinguished from UFOs, separate subject, allied but separate. The saucer period went right through the 50s and into the late 60s. The preoccupation with Roswell actually didn't begin until the very late 60s. They were, it's curious, but so much of that was covered up that it was just, although I do cover it in my book, it was still, there were so many instances of phenomena that one did not particularly stand up. People were much more interested in the Maury Island case, for example, than the Roswell case. So it became what it is today.
Yeah.
Only in the last
like I said, we're going to do a show about that sometime. But what kind of guy was Long John? Was he a tall guy?
Yes, 6'3".
Okay.
And slender as a rail, and always in very good shape, and he never exercised.
What were some of his favorite topics? I guess the UFOs, the flying saucers.
Well, the UFOs, flying saucers, magic. He did a great many shows. shows on medicine. There's no branch of medicine you could think of that he didn't show, do shows on. He didn't do the celebrity bit that Barry Gray and people like that.
Mm-hmm.
He was totally uninterested in people because they had publicists. He did have some people on that were well known, but only because he thought they were interesting, not because they were celebrities.
Well, now you know, in that 50s and 60s time, reading your stuff, I detected some excitement there, but you and I have corresponded a little bit by email since then, and you pointed out it was just an exciting time, and you happened to be in Greenwich Village, and I guess that is true.
Yeah, well, you know, I was meeting so many interesting people. In those days, I knew Steve McQueen, for example. I knew John Carradine, a character actor. So many... painted. Well, I also among the poets, I knew two of the last of the five great poets. I knew W.H. Auden. I'm speaking very casually, not as a deep personal friendship, but I had spent time sitting on a bench in Washington Square talking with him about verse, and I knew E.E. Cummings very, very casually. So they were... you know, it was a place of celebrities, as well as people that no one has ever heard of, who were almost as interesting as the celebrities, in some cases more so.
Well, you know, I've been doing talk shows for 45 years, and I've done my share of celebrity shows. I used to broadcast out of Las Vegas full-time. However, I find that the really interesting shows are with people that you never heard of, that, for lack of a better term, are experiencers, not only in UFOs and ETs, but anything, conspiracies or whatever.
Well, I agree with you completely, because the simple truth is, unfortunately, it's somewhat disillusioning, but celebrities that are theatrical, movie people and stage people are more interesting, but movie people in general, once you get them out of their roles, they're just not very interesting people. Of course, that doesn't apply to a writer or who has to think
sure.
To do his work. But you don't have to think to be a good actor. And it reminds me of an anecdote about Vincent Price was in the restaurant, and he saw this kid, what he thought of as a kid, sitting at the bar, and he seemed to be very kind of unhappy, concerned, etc. And he walked over, and he knew he'd seen him before. And when the kid turned around, he realized that it was this young man that just come out through the coast named James Dean, whom I also knew, by the way. And he said, "What's the matter, Mr. Dean, or Jimmy, or whatever you called him?" He said, "Well, I have this role coming up, and I'm trying to really, you know, get inside the character. I'm trying to really understand it." And he went on like this for a couple of minutes. And Price said, "Well, I have a suggestion." And Dean said, what is that, Mr. Price?" He said, "Well, why don't you try acting?" That applied to so many,
sure.
The level of intelligence among people.
Right.
This still leaves a lot to be desired.
November 22nd, 1963, were you guys doing a show that night?
No, well, when...
Kennedy was shot.
When he was killed, I had a studio in Greenwich Village.
Hold on a minute, Paris. We have to take a break. But when we come back, let's pick it up with the news about where you were when you heard that John F. Kennedy had been killed.
Hi, this is Rod C. Davis. I have a question. Do you love to travel? Then you need to check out YTV's weekly travel deals and steals. Just go to the Travel Store and More banner, click on the Business and Vacation Travel link, and then sign up for the Deals and Steals newsletter for great deals every week to America's favorite vacation spots. And while you're logged on, you can send flowers to that special person, buy your perfect car, buy tickets to attractions, book an exotic hunting or fishing trip, set up a honeymoon registry, and much more. Just click on the extras link and take advantage of YTB's huge purchasing power that saves you money. And if you'd like to save a lot of money on your travel, then check out the Travel Business Opportunity link. and find out how you could earn a commission each and every time that you book a trip. You can be sure that Travelocity, Orbitz, and Expedia won't do that. Click on the banner and bookmark the page for your future use. You can save money and make money at the same time. Check us out.
Paris Flamond is our guest, and we're talking about his experiences with Jim Garrison, the famed DA down in New Orleans, who actually brought charges of conspiracy to commit murder against Clay Shaw and others in connection with the JFK assassination. Paris, when we left, we were talking about, where we were on the day itself, November 22nd, 1963. I think all of us that were alive at that time do remember where we were when we heard the news about the assassination. So why don't you go ahead and pick up the story right where you were when we went to the break, when you heard the news, if you don't mind,
and when they first heard about it.
In my life, and I've lived very varied life, only 2 days do I remember as literally, to use the cliche, as if they were not yesterday, if they were this afternoon. And one was when I was very young, when Roosevelt had died. He'd been president all my life, my young life. And when Jack Kennedy was murdered, I remember pretty clearly the day Bobby was killed, but not as much as I do those other two.
Yeah, same here. I was in California, in San Francisco at the time.
Oh, yes, that must have been very immediate for you.
Yes, it was, and I happened to be coming out of, actually, over in Alameda at a jazz radio station. I had gone up to see about a job, and I...
Was this in L.A.?
In San Francisco, Alameda, Alameda, on the little island in the East Bay. That's where the jazz station was. And they were playing jazz music, and I was listening to Al Jazz Bo Collins on another station, KSFO, in San Francisco. And when I went in, he was playing, regular pop music. When I came back down, it happened between the time I left that little jazz station and the time I got to the parking lot in my car, they were playing classical music. And it made an impression on everybody. And, of course, everybody remembers Walter Cronkite breaking up on the air. On television.
The only other thing I ever remember that was quite like what we both have experienced was sitting in a cafe in Greenwich Village during the Cuban Missile Crisis when Jack Kennedy was going to come on and announce exactly what the United States was going to do in the face of atomic weapons in Cuba. And I mean, that was the most moribund.
And it was a dynamic event, and most people...
Everybody was terrified what they were. They were afraid we were on the world.
Well, yeah, it looked like it was the beginning of the unthinkable, a nuclear war.
Yeah.
It really did. So your fascination with the JFK assassination, how did that get started?
It was immediate. I mean, I was working on other books at the time, but I didn't... It didn't occur to me to do a book on it, and it didn't for several years until I was approached to do one. But the impact was very great, and I admired him considerably, almost as much as I admired his brother. And it was a strange, and I did not admire Lyndon Johnson. So it was a disturbing period for me, but then I went on about my writing and so on and so forth, and it wasn't until about 4 years later that I was approached to do the book, The Kennedy Conspiracy.
Now who proposed that to you, a publisher?
No, my agent. Okay. He called up and one day, and he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm working on the manuscript. I was in the middle of a book, and he said, well, we have a problem. And I said, what? And he said, can you do 2 books at one time? And like being giving the response that any writer in his right mind would give, I said, of course.
Well, naturally, right.
I'm going to give up the advance and everything. And I say no. And so I said, but on what subject? I didn't even know the subject. And he said, on the Kennedy assassination. And I said, but, you know, Mark Lane's already done something on that, and a couple of other people. And he said, no, not on that part of it. You know who Jim Garrison is? And I said, oh, yeah, of course, I've read about him. He said, you have to go down and talk to him and do his story, do his investigation of the assassination. How did it sound? And I said, one way or another, I'll do both books simultaneously, and I did.
So they gave you enough money to get down to New Orleans and do some investigating on your own.
And the advance was fairly good for those days. I mean, for somebody that was, you know, a major celebrity. But
you had never met Jim Garrison until you walked in and told him you were going to do a book?
No, first I called Baldwin's office, and I said, I've been asked to do a book. I need only one to know only one thing. And he said, well, and he started to tell me about the investigation. And I said, no, that's not what I have to know. What I have to know is, am I going to get the office's, your complete cooperation in doing it? And he said, absolutely, absolutely. And he certainly gave it to me. And later on, he came up and visited me in New York a couple of times, and, you know, took him to the theater and restaurants and all that sort of thing. So we got to know each other extremely well.
So your opinion of Jim Garrison is a high one?
He was one of the most powerful personalities, and I have met a lot of people, but he is one of the most powerful personalities I ever met. Because you were asking how tall John was. Jim was also almost 6'3", but John was slender as a rail, and Jim was built like a fullback. I mean, he wasn't overweight, but he was, you know, very solidly, powerfully built, and he had great personal charms. Had strange, very large eyes, very large blue eyes. Peculiar. They were slightly protrusive, and
bug-eyed almost.
So when he was in the room, it was hard to, you know, pay attention to anybody else. Of course, he had a big booming voice that went, large body. But he was somewhat mercurial. He would get onto an idea, and he would really be interested in it. And but the minute somebody could say, "But Jim, if this is true, and this is true, and this is true, what you're saying can't be true," and he'd say, "Yes, that makes sense. The second point I don't know about, and the third point makes sense. Okay, we'll just get rid of that."
So, in other words, he was open to all kinds of possibilities, but he shut the door easily as well.
He was completely receptive to ideas, to evidence, to suggestions. He was extraordinarily intelligent.
Yeah.
Well, he was intruding where the government did not want him to intrude. Even going all the way up to the Attorney General, they were doing everything to thwart him. They were set up the newspapers to thwart him. People like Sheridan, who was an ex intelligence agent for the government and was then a newspaper man. They did everything in the world to destroy him. If they thought he was wrong, all they had to do was give him all the assistance they could and let him fall on his own face. But they didn't. They were afraid that he wasn't wrong, and so they tried to stymie him in every possible way.
When you say they were afraid he wasn't wrong, you think a lot of them didn't know one way or the other.
Well, Jim thought that eventually, although he considered in my let's see, was to the heaven the first book? Anyway, set of four. In the first book, I list something like 30 theories that were posited. And, so, you know, I list all the kooky ones, too, just to be fair. And but when any intelligent person would have eliminated half of them automatically, and anybody who knows the case would have eliminated another six or seven, so you get down to the only people that could have done it are within the group of, say, five. And if you study further, you will realize that a couple of those are improbable in the nth degree. So eventually it is awfully hard not to come to a conclusion of who was primarily involved, not only in that, but with Bobby and King and the rest of them.
So you've narrowed it down in your own mind to two or three groups or people?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We're going to get into that here in a little bit. One of those things you mentioned in your book, which I've done a lot of shows on the subject, but I guess I'm showing my ignorance here. You talk about the old Catholic Church. What do you mean by that?
Let me mitigate your self-castigation. Very few people, including all those people who pontificate about it, know a great deal about the case. So, you know, if you don't know certain elements in it, it's perfectly understandable unless you've researched it for 20 years. The old Catholic Church is a schism from the RC. It's conceived its history in a couple of different ways. Some people say that it really broke away about 400 years ago, but other people say, well, it was really finalized in the 1870s when the Pope declared ex cathedra that he was infallible in matters of morals and principles of the Church. Most people don't know. Even the educated people know that that did happen. What they don't know is that the two-thirds of all the cardinals that should have approved this new regimen in the Church either voted no or walked out. So it was a very dictatorial decision. So the people that had not joined the old Catholics already, a lot of them, especially in the ministry, went over to it. And the old Catholic Church in itself does not accept the primacy of the purge approach, Pope, I get that word out, and it has basically the same principles. It's not Protestant in any sense. It has priests and bishops. However, it does allow its priests to marry. In this country, it has had a rather narrow genealogy. It came down to two bishops, a man named Cafora and a man named Brothers. The brothers ended up living on a mountaintop in Woodstock and reverted eventually to, I guess it was the Greek National Church. And Cafora was mad as a hatter and declared Lake Michigan all holy water, and anybody who bathed in it was converted and whatever. So it's an extremely strange church. A great many of its clergy are gay. But of course, that is becoming more and more and more evident that so are they in the RC. So it's not so distinguishable from the Roman Church as it used to be thought to be, although never particularly was.
Now, when we talk about the Catholic Church being involved, did you eliminate them?
Not the Catholic.
Yeah, right. I understand. I mean, JFK himself was a new Catholic, I guess.
He was a very legitimate Catholic, yeah. The whole family is. I mean, the Kennedys, the Boston Catholics, you know, of whom there is nothing more Catholic. The old Catholic Church claimed among its members, Gordon Novell claimed to have been ordained.
Oh, you brought his name up. I'm going to ask you about him in a little bit in more detail. Go ahead.
Familiar with Bannister?
Yes.
Well, Bannister had an assistant named Jack Martin, and Jack Martin claimed to be a priest in the old Catholic Church. And there were several other people that claimed to have had the ordination. And in almost every instance, it's specious or...
I know Gordon Novell. He doesn't seem to be very religious.
Oh, no. Well, he's a devout opportunist. If there's a way to get his name in the paper, he's there.
He was down there during that time, too, I guess. Did you meet him?
Jim once said that I should meet him, And I said, fine. He said, I'll set it up. And a week later, he said, he won't talk to you. I wanted to meet him just to interview him for the book, you know.
Yeah.
And he said, Jim said, he won't talk to you. And I said, yeah, okay. A lot of people won't. So I never actually.
What do you think Jim really thought of Gordon Novell?
Not much. He thought he was an opportunist. I mean, it was very hard to know anything about him and not think he was an opportunist. One had to decide for oneself whether was he connected with the company or wasn't he. Was he ever down in Mexico or wasn't he? How well did he know Oswald? Or did he really ever know him?
And you never really got a chance to visit with Gordon about that.
No,
But did you draw the conclusion that Novell knew Oswald?
I think it was very likely that he met him. There's a big difference between knowing and meeting. But I don't think it's relevant.
Sure.
I don't think that Novell had. Was that anywhere involved in the crime? And certainly, I don't think that.
Have you heard about the umbrella man story about Novell waving the umbrella during the shootings? You know those films.
Oh, you mean being the umbrella? No, he definitely was not the umbrella man.
Okay.
No question about that. That's another attempt to be somebody. You know that people will pay attention to.
Yeah. Now. I think maybe even Gordon confessed to me one time that he was standing in the way of the Garrison investigation, insinuating he was part of the company, whether he was or not, I don't know.
Well, there are those who believe that he was paid to disrupt Garrison's investigation as much as possible, and I don't know that anything he ever did disrupted it terribly. But he certainly was not cooperative, as he said.
Let me ask you this much: Was Garrison surprised that his case fell apart like it did?
No, he thought that the trial would demonstrate that Shaw had been involved. The many members of the jury, by the way, afterwards, said that they thought that there was a great likelihood that he was, but there was simply not enough evidence to bring in beyond a shadow of a doubt. After it was not a popularity contest, it was a trial, and if they couldn't convince themselves that he was guilty of, remember, he wasn't accused of doing the crime. He was convinced of being a conspirator in the construction of the crime. And they simply didn't believe they could accept that beyond a shadow.
Now, you got along with Jim Garrison rather well, and he became a friend. His conclusions and your conclusions about the JFK murders, do they coincide?
No. Jim was loath to think that it had anything to do with our own government. He went through several phases, which any district attorney does. You know, as the evidence comes in, first it looks like one person, then it looks like somebody else, and then he discards the third, etc. He was very inclined towards the Cuban theory at one point. But then evidence came out that Kennedy had been in contact with Castro, who had been writing back and forth and trying to establish a détente, and it was evident to him that if that was the case, then certainly Castro wasn't going to be responsible for any harm coming to Kennedy, because he knew perfectly well that he would be succeeded by Johnson, and he would never make a deal with Johnson. So Jim had to discard that possibility. He considered the Russian possibility, thought it was unlikely because he could never see anything that the Russians would have to gain, and I agree with him on that point. Probably his main target towards the end was the syndicate and or the company, and I think he ultimately probably believed that it was a combination of both a renegade element of the company and probably a practical element of the mafia.
Well, you know, if you're a district attorney in New Orleans, you have lots of experience dealing with mafia cases.
Well, he of course knew Marcello, and he didn't personally know Traficante, but he did know Marcello because Marcello was sitting right there in New Orleans for a quarter of a century. Probably the most curious, and all the years I knew Jim, and all the research I did with and for him, the one thing that I will give you some material for hypothesis that I never could quite get my mind around was Jim never accepted if you stated something about Marcello and the mafia, he would say, "Oh, don't believe everything you hear," or "I have no reason to believe that he's really involved," or etc. In other words, he disavowed any conviction that Marcello, who was unquestionably the godfather in that part of the country, was in point of fact just that, and leaves one wondering. But I've never come up with an answer for that.
Was he in the mafia's pocket? I don't think so, Jim Garrison. He seems like he was a pretty independent character down there.
He was tremendously independent. Matter of fact, he got elected originally without the support of the Republican or the Democratic Party. He ran as an independent. He was reelected again, and then he was reelected again. He was the most popular district attorney the New Orleans ever had, and made one of the most popular in the country. If he had kept his hands off of the Kennedy assassination, the probability that he would have been senator or governor is about 5-1 in his favor. But he just simply demolished his career by beginning this investigation.
Now, in his latter years, did you have an occasion to talk to him or be around him?
No, after the case was over, and we were in touch up to the time of the House Committee on Assassinations somewhat from time to time, but our relationship was almost completely based upon on the case. We did not have familial contacts, or our reading habits were not the same, etc. Once the case was over, as far as it ever being solved is concerned, we just had very little left to talk about, and our relationship sort of dwindled. We occasionally spoke over a period of about 7-8 years, that was an awful long time ago, over 40 years ago. So we finally just drifted apart. And then, of course, he became quite ill, and he was bedridden for the last year of his life.
He doesn't strike me as a man that would take defeat very easily, probably the reason he was a good district attorney to begin with.
Oh, he fought as long as he could, but once he brought someone to trial, and he was utterly thwarted. He was not permitted to bring in certain witnesses. He was not permitted to introduce certain testimony. As a matter of fact, he had, by the
end... Well, do you think the judge was working with the government preventing this, or what?
Well, I can't make an evaluation of that. Everybody else was. I don't see why... if you're in a public position... One thing you don't want to do if you care about your career is you don't want to make the people above you mad.
Why do these people, the huge group, we still have it all the time, saying why do they not want the truth out?
Well, remember that we really still don't know all the facts about the Lincoln's assassination. We don't know really all of the facts about the Kennedy's assassination. The country has always been protected against knowing that there was an attempt in 1933 to overthrow the government, take Roosevelt prisoner, and declare martial law.
Now, who was behind that?
Allegedly, Al Smith may have been involved, but the man that they wanted to lead it, and his name is just at my mind just for the moment, was a major military figure, and I have never heard of anyone winning the Medal of Honor twice. He had won it twice. He must have been.
When we talk about the Kennedy assassination, the murderer of a president, you know, all kinds of people come to mind. In my estimation, the military-industrial complex, the CIA, the mafia, were they working together? Down in Dallas, it was a big right-wing group, H.L. Hunt. Even the police chief was a right-winger.
You know, in the Bobby case, now it's people who do the kind of work that I do have long suspected that the company was involved. But that the Los Angeles Police Department was involved, and now it's come out that three of the now conveniently dead CIA men were in the kitchen at the time. Mm-hmm. Now it is established almost beyond any doubt that
and there were extra bullets the police never counted.
That there were between 10 and 13 bullets, and his gun held 8. He was in the wrong position. Bobby had bullet holes in his back, and Ciaran was about 4 feet in front of him. At the closest that he ever got was 3 or 4 feet in front of him. I mean, just, you know, there is an element that rules this country that has nothing to do with anybody that gets elected.
With the same people that killed Bobby Kennedy, the same ones that killed his brother John? Maybe not the same people.
Oh yeah, and King, it's quite possible that Malcolm may have been included in the group too. Possible that Rockwell was included in the group. People who make waves, people who disturb the equilibrium. You know, you can get away with a great deal, and so long as you're not really disturbing anything that vital, nobody's going to bother you. But you begin to really shake things up, and it's amazing how many people go. Yeah, I mean, you can go to other people like Forrest Stahl.
Yeah, he conveniently committed suicide, but there was ever evidence that he didn't want to go out that window.
The guy was killed in the plane crash.
The senator from Minnesota.
Yes, exactly.
I've always said if you're a liberal Democrat, you don't want to fly in a private plane.
It's amazing. You can just keep on going on and on and on and on, you know.
So who are these people, the groups, I mean? Who are we talking about?
Well, now you're getting into very rarefied stuff, but it is the cartel, the melding of the people who are most often responsible for getting a president elected, a major senator being elected, is the kind of group that is of which David Rockefeller is more powerful than the president. He has been more powerful than the president for decades. The people who are involved in the Bilderberg group, the people who are involved in the Council on Foreign.
Why would Rockefeller, for instance, want to knock off JFK?
Well, he's the one who created the Trilateral Commission.
And so you think it all goes back to...
Oh, the Trilateral Commission and the
Bilderberg group?
They're all interlocked, especially with the Bilderberg group, and they are, of course, interlocked with all of the powers that be in Europe. And Japan, but not in China, because of course we can't do anything to them. But other major countries, parts of the world that just don't figure at all. Most of Africa and most of South America, but if they were needed, they would be brought into the fold.
Well, now, was, I mean, the Kennedy brothers eliminated and Martin Luther King eliminated because they just didn't like what they were saying, or were they getting in people's pockets, or what? I mean, in other words...
He said at one point regarding the CIA, direct quote, "I will smash it to smithereens."
And it's pretty well known that he left them hanging there on the Bay of Pigs. Yes.
Well, he didn't really, he just didn't come in and save them because that wasn't his operation, it was theirs.
Right.
People think the president has this ultimate power, but the president's power is very limited except when he breaks the law, like Bush, who has broken something, I don't know, I saw a list of it the other day, something like 212 laws and statutes since he came into office. But
how come no one's tried to prosecute him yet?
Well, that's a good question, and
I don't have an answer for that either.
It's just that we have never had a public that is so indolent, so preoccupied with itself that it's simply the old thing. If you give me what I want, I won't care if you take everything else. And people that in this country live better than anywhere else in the world. This country has about 80% of all the wealth of the world.
Yeah,
I mean, 3.5% of the population.
One of the things I've marveled about the neoconservative movement and Bush in particular is the fact that evidently if you spread the wealth around a lot, you can get away with a lot. Doesn't have to be a lot of money to each one. But if they're all making it...
The elections are won.
We've only got about a minute or two left. I want to give a big plug for your book and all of that later.
There's a film made probably before you were going to films much called The Great McGinty. And the beginning of this career of the guy who becomes very powerful is he comes in and he has this bunch of papers in his hand, and they indicate how many times he's voted, and the guy says, "How many times did you vote?" And he said, 22. Dollar for every one he voted. It's a marvelous center.
It's amazing what's happened to our vote as far as voting machines and all of that too. We could go on for hours here. After 3.5 years and 1,600 and some odd pages, you're not going to give me any names, huh?
1,800,
okay.
You're going to have to cut about 8 minutes out of this to make it fit an hour.
Oh, well, we'll get it there.
Well, nice talking with you.
Okay, and we'll talk to you later.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.